Hello, Billy Patterson here. Nearly 30 years ago on my Castaway programs, I talked with local people about their lives. Stay tuned and listen again to the following fascinating story. Welcome to another Castaway. Now, I don't suppose I have to tell you what the Castaway program is about now, but I will anyway, just in case you haven't heard it before. We take a well-known person from the northwest of Ireland. We deposit them on a desert island. We give them 6 records to take with them that would mean something to them, that they wouldn't get tired of playing as they sat staring out over the endless sea. We give them 2 books to take with them, apart from the Bible, and 1 luxury. Now, our castaway this week, I am delighted indeed to tell you that it is Dr. Tom McGinley. Dr. Tom, the founder, I would think, of the hospice movement in the northwest of Ireland. Tom, you're very welcome indeed.
Thank you very much, Billy. I'm delighted to be here.
Good, good.
In my native county.
Now, Tom, first question, where were you born and when were you born?
Well, on Boxing Day 1934, I was born in Brooklyn, New York. My parents were there, and I wasn't long. We didn't stay long in New York, because that was when the big recession took place, and my father couldn't get any employment, so we had to head back to West Donegal, to Gweedore.
What was your father doing in New York?
In those days, in actual fact, it got to the stage where he was actually any work whatsoever that he could get, and there were weeks and days and weeks in which he couldn't get work. And sometimes the only work he could get was out clearing up the snow and things like that. I mean, it was really the recession.
Right, Tom, beg your pardon. Let's go back a little before even those days. Now, your father was a Gweedore man.
He was a Gweedore man. My mother was a Gweedore woman.
And they got married in Gweedore?
They got married in Gweedore. My mother was actually born out in the Black Hills of Dakota. My grandfather was out there, obviously, prospecting for gold. She was born there in the Black Hills in 1904. And came then back to Gweedore. My grandfather came back. And she had gone to the States, I think about once, on one other occasion, and then went out after they got married. My older brother, Gene, who's a year older than I am, he was born in Derry. And he spent his first birthday on the Atlantic, and I then spent his second birthday on the Atlantic coming back from New York.
They never seemed to want to stay, Tom. Why was that? They wanted to keep coming home. The family. They didn't go out and say, right, we're going out here and we're going to stay. What happened? Why did they not?
Of course, it's very difficult if you're from Gweedore not to want to come back. I mean, you know, that I think obviously would have to be the most important thing.
It's the call.
Call of West Donegal. And I mean, you've got to come from West Donegal to realise that.
Well, I think any of Donegal.
But especially, you know, West Donegal. I think there is something about it.
There's a glue there.
And, you know, once you go in there, and once I get to the foot of Errigal, Billy, I'm a different person.
How does it make you different?
I'm relaxed and, you know.
You mean you could be a ball of tension approaching?
I could be tension, and the minute I see Errigal, that disappears. And a lot of other people who actually don't come from Gweedore at all have said the exact same thing to me, that when they come to the foot of Errigal, then that's it. And as far as I'm concerned, that will always, you know, to me, be cheering the nog.
Is it because Errigal is so sort of large and it makes you feel so insignificant that you wonder what the hell you were worrying about in the first place?
Yeah, well, you are then insignificant because you're among your own people, and you should always be insignificant among your own people. You're just one of them.
Do you feel that?
Oh, I feel that, yeah. And you don't have to be pretending that you're a doctor or anything else. You're just one of themselves. Mm. And that's the way it should be. Mm. You know, that's where you were rare. That's where you were really, you enjoyed yourself. And I had a very, very happy upbringing in West Donegal.
Well, I'll tell you now, we will go on to that in a second, but I know that inadvertently there, when you were telling me about your mother, you also indicated what your first piece of music just might be to take to this island with you.
Yes, well, when my father came back from the States, he couldn't find any employment and he had to go to Glasgow. And we stayed at home in Derrybeg, and my grandfather became the father figure in the family.
Yeah.
And the very first song that I can ever, bit of music can ever remember was, he used to sing on a regular basis, the spot actually where my mother was born was the Black Hills of Dakota.
And your grandfather was out there prospecting.
Yes, he.
And your mother was born out there.
Born there, yes. And when we were growing up, when we were small kids, that was the song he always sang, especially if he had a pint of beer or something. He wasn't a drinking man. Mm. But on a fair day in Derrybeg, there was every month there was a fair. And some friends might take him over to the pub across the street for a jar. And he would always come back and sing that song.
So you would like to have it with you on the island?
Beautiful Indian country that I love. Lost my heart in the Black Hills of Dakota, where the pines are so high that they kiss the sky above. And some feeling, and a miles away from home, I hear the voice of the mystic mountains calling me back home. So take me back to the Black Hills, the Black Hills of Dakota, to the beautiful Indian country that I love.
Nice rendition there of the Black Hills of Dakota by Miss Doris Day. Now, Tom, you went to school in Derrybeg, did you?
I went to school in Derrybeg initially. That was very, very close to us. And then, after a few years there, my mother decided to send us to Gull Island because my aunt's husband taught there, and she reckoned that we would get private tuition in that school because it was a very small school.
Mm.
And of course we did get private tuition there, and my brother and I spent 1 year on that island.
Was it all through the medium of Irish, by the way?
Oh yes, all. Yeah.
It was now it was Irish you spoke
no,
all the time.
We had to learn English.
Mm. But at home, you're natural first.
Oh, yes, of course.
Even
yes.
Now?
Even now. Yeah. I mean, if I went down home now and started to talk in English, I mean, I would get shot.
Would you?
I wouldn't want to talk in English down in Gwydor anyway.
Doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem right, you know, or if my sister rings me up on the phone or anything like that. I mean, it would always have to be Irish.
Oh, well, now, sure, I would conduct this interview through Irish, but yes. In due deference to the lot of people who listen who can't speak.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
that's the only reason, yeah. Tom, that I wouldn't conduct right, this through yeah. the medium of Irish, you know. Was there anybody in those very early school days that you have, you say that, you know, when you think back, now that person really influenced me?
I think all my teachers influenced me. I spent a year in Gull Island, and then I got very homesick. Even though I could go up and look out on the island, I could see our house in Derrybeg.
Could you?
But, you know, at 9 years of age, so then we came out and we went to Lunya School. And there Ned Gallagher was our teacher, and Ned is still alive. And I was talking to him a few weeks ago.
Mm.
And he really worked very hard. And we used to go in on a Saturday morning, prepare for exams. Because we realised, of course, that unless we got a scholarship, that I would have had to follow the same path my father did, and that is to take the Glasgow boat. There wasn't any other choice in those days.
Mm. Mm.
So we did work very, very hard. That doesn't say we didn't enjoy ourselves. As I said, we had a very, very happy upbringing in West Donegal. People say, well, times were tough. I never found them tough. There weren't many luxuries around.
Mm.
But, I mean, who wants luxuries?
Mm.
I mean, we had the warmth of the home.
Mm.
There was plenty for us to do.
Plenty of love.
Lots of love.
Lots of love.
Yeah.
But your dad was the one who really wasn't at home. You didn't really got to know him, did you?
Never got to know him, Billy. And, of course, that is
a big loss.
It's a big, big loss. We just saw him 2 weeks in the year. He came home for the Glasgow Fair. And that was it. And I remember recently making the remark that, and it was only years later that I understood what it was all about. When he came off that bus in Derrybeg, coming home, he didn't go into our house straight away, because he went for a pint or whatever it was, and he wasn't a drinking man. And it was only years later that I knew that was Dutch courage, because he was a stranger, and we were basically strangers to him.
Did your mother talk about him a lot when he was away?
Yes, she talked about him, but we were very lucky, of course, that we had a mother, because she was certainly was my motivator. And from a very, very early stage, she encouraged us to study and pointed out to us that really, if we wanted a future which was different than that of my father, then we had to study.
Mm.
And she gave us every possible encouragement.
In a way, Tom, the fact that your father was the sort of person he was, if you like, indirectly responsible for the fact that your mother insisted that you study and that you saw them as a
woman. Oh, yes, very much. It must have been a very, very tough life for him. And it's only in later years when I had children of my own that I realised what a loss must have been to him.
Yeah.
In those early days, Billy, I didn't appreciate the sacrifices he was making, because there were times and I would have said to myself, you know, it's not right that he's away from us, not realising that he didn't have an option. And it was only in later years, and the unfortunate thing about later years, it was then too late to build up that rapport that is necessary between a father and son.
Did he send money home?
Oh, yes, every month that money arrived home.
So the man did, in fact, sacrifice himself.
He sacrificed himself completely.
He did.
Worked 6-7 days a week, came home for 2 weeks in a year. Didn't have the satisfaction of seeing us passing exams. He got all that secondhand, getting scholarships and that sort. But as I've said, my mother became a major, major influence.
Well, how many children were in the family, Tom, at this stage?
Well, my older brother, Jean, who's a year older than me, Breed then came along a few years later, and then much later on, my youngest brother, Packy. And of course, Breed and Packy, both, of course, were born or conceived during the Glasgow Fair holidays.
That follows.
So, in other words, that's why their birthdays are obviously around April, May.
Well, just about now. I didn't ask you, but your parents are no longer with us, I expect.
No, my father died. He's been dead now over 23 years, and my mother died in January 86, so
not so long ago.
No, and her influence obviously continued, but she was an unbelievable person in that I don't think I've ever met anybody who was so unselfish as her. She was totally and utterly unselfish. And also very, very wise person. And people now talk, you know, kids think when they go to bed and you read them stories and all of this. We went to bed at night with a dictionary. And she would say, try to get us to spell words, to learn English words. And we enjoyed it. You know,
she made a game out of it.
Oh, she made a game out of it, you know. And we used to loved looking forward to at night to go to bed to learn a bit about English and spelling and all of that. And as I say, it was a very, very happy upbringing, you know.
She must have been a remarkable woman, Tony.
She was indeed.
Let's go for your second choice of record. What would that be, Tom, and why?
Well, I think the second comes basically when, you know, reminds me really of once primary school was open or national school was open, then started going to St. Union's, to college and various things like that, is when we started possibly cycling to dances and things in West Donegal, to Ross's, to Dunloe and places like that. And I actually often remember coming back from dances, because as you know in Donegal and those, they didn't start till 1 or 2 in the morning. And they weren't over till 3 or 4 in the morning.
Oh, at least.
And I remember actually coming cycling home with the dawn breaking and actually going to Mass in Derrybeg on my way home and then going home and heading off to the bog for the day. So my second choice has to be Mary from Dunloe, because it reminds me basically of all of West Donegal.
Oh, then fare thee well, sweet Donegal, the Rosses and with all. I'm crossing the main ocean, where the foaming
wishes they were in Sweet Dunloe. That's the Emmett Spiceland. Do you remember they brought out the first record there at that time? There were contemporaries of ours.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I think we were in the Kilkenny Beer Festival together. Mm-hmm. That's where we first sort of started our careers. Now, Tom, by the way, in case you've just tuned in your radio, I'm talking to Dr. Tom McGinley. My name's Billy Patterson, and the programme is called Castaway. Now, Tom, your early days were down in the West, and then you came to secondary school in Letterkenny, didn't you, St.
Union's? In St. Union's, yeah. I spent 7 years 5 years here, from 1947 to 1952, as a boarder in St.
That
James.
Was to do your...
And that those were tough years, Billy.
Why was that?
I think, first of all, I was constantly homesick.
Were you?
Secondly, I always felt hungry.
You're not getting enough to eat in some
And it was tough. It was tough. I mean, getting up at, 6 in the morning to go to Mass, to go into a cold study and study for an hour before breakfast. And I used to envy the day student pupils who used to come in. But it was a tough... but I think it helped me for later life. Maybe toughened me a bit too much. And that was why I was determined that none of my own family would ever go to a boarding school. But I think it has changed now anyway.
Well, was Eugene there at the same time?
Eugene he was a year ahead of me.
Mm.
And this thing about wanting to get on in life and studying, that was made very clear to me. For some reason, I was a few weeks late in coming to St. Union's in my first year. I can't remember exactly. There was some question that I might have had to go to Summerhill in Sligo. And obviously I got behind with things, with geometry, etc. The very first day after our lunch or dinner, first thing Jean did was take me up to his room and sat down and said, "You have a catching up to do." And I mean, he would only been about 13 at the time. So all along we felt, right, there has to be a goal here. We've got to get to university.
Mm.
And that really, and that sort of sticks with you, you know.
Are you still close to...
Very close, yeah. Mm. He lives in Milford. He teaches in Milford. And we went to school the same day. We played football together. We did everything. Mm. And I think it was very important.
Mm.
And even before exams in St. Union's, with lights out at 10 o'clock at night, we used to study under the pillows. Sorry, under under the sheets.
And the torch.
With the torch, you know. Used to get up maybe at... Even though we used to have to get up at 6 in the morning, we used to get up maybe half an hour beforehand and study. So it was...
And this was a self-motivated thing?
Oh, yes, it was self-motivation.
Was it a desire not to let Mother down?
Partly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think possibly you're right there. I think that's the most important thing. Yeah.
Yeah. She would have felt dreadful if you had failed. You would have felt dreadful if you
had
failed.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And I remember even before term exams in St. Union's, I used to go sick for a few days before the exams, purely because I would have more time in my room to study.
I understand that. Yeah.
But St. Union's I think it prepared us for the tough outside world.
But you were also a tough man in the playing field, I heard. Is that right?
Well, we played a lot of Gaelic. I mean, there wasn't, as I say, Gaelic was basically our pastime. We grew up with it in Gwydor.
Mm.
I played a lot of Gaelic in St. Union's. Mm. I played subsequently a lot of Gaelic. And it was a very, very important part of my life, playing Gaelic football.
Well, I mean, I think you're holding back on me a wee bit here, Tom, because you were one of about three people or something in the history of St. Union's who was actually chosen to represent Ulster schools. Is that not right?
Yeah, in those days, yeah, it was quite an honour, actually, to be chosen for Ulster Colleges.
Ulster Colleges, yeah. 1952 was the year.
1952, and in actual fact, we won the Inter-Colleges Championship that year in Croke Park. And it was quite an honour in those days.
That was your first taste of glory, wasn't it, really?
Yes, indeed, that was, and it was a great honour.
Well, apart from working very hard yourself, and Eugene dragging you along to get you started, or Jean, I call him Jean, and the influence of your mother, was there anybody in the actual school that strongly influenced you in any direction?
Ah, yes. There was one teacher and a priest, and he died there. He's died in the last number of years, and I think he had a tremendous influence on me. Was Dr. Cunha. And you would have known Dr. Cunha. He was very much into music and things. He was a very, very kindly person, and indeed, I built up a great rapport with him. And it was sad to see that my recollection of him leaving this life was seeing him very ill in an intensive care unit in Altnagalvin Hospital. But he was a lovely, gentle person. He would have been the one in St. Union's that would have had the greatest influence on me, and again encouraged me, talked a lot to me about joining the priesthood.
You had aspirations, did you?
Well, then I discovered that there was the opposite sex, Billy, and, you know, and I felt right,
Right. We'll leave the opposite sex for a minute. Just let me ask you what your third choice of music would be now, Tom, before we go into an ad break.
Right, well, I think from then on I went on to Galway, and I spent 8 happy years in Galway, 6 at university and 2 in Ballinasloe.
Right.
And obviously the fields of Athenry would always remember me of, remind me of those days. Of those just 8 very happy years in Galway. I would say Galway people are the closest you will get to Donegal.
Is that right?
Yes.
I didn't think of that.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's hear Paddy Riley singing "The Fields of Athenry." You're very welcome back to Castaway. You're listening to Dr. Tom McGinley. We're talking about Tom's life. Now, Tom, you've left St. Union's and you've gone to Galway. And what was the social life like in Galway in those days? Was this a big revelation to you, or was
not so much a revelation, but it was a complete change about it. I mean, gone was this tension of wanting to get exams, etc. And to me, the 6 years as a medical student in Galway was just one big long holiday, Billy. Just one big long holiday.
Was it?
I never worked too hard, just sufficient to get through the exams. Headed off every summer to London to work for a few months, got enough money for clothes, shoes and things like that, and back again. And the pressure was off.
Really. Why did you choose to do medicine instead of the church? You were saying that you discovered girls and that kind of
thing. Well, that wasn't the main reason. I decided to do medicine. I did medicine completely and utterly by accident. I went into medicine by accident. I had no idea that I would have finished up doing medicine.
You had no strong idea?
Oh, none whatsoever. I left home, and I remember when I left home asking my mother what I should do at university. And she said to me, she didn't really know what to advise me. And she said, you can choose whatever you want, she said, and then made me promise that I would never smoke and never drink. And I have never broken those promises for that reason.
First girlfriend there, I expect.
Ah, no, it came before that.
Did it?
Yes. Ah, yes, you know. I mean, yeah.
Were you going to the dances in Letterkenny and all while you were here? But you're only a lad, 13.
Yeah, well, but the amazing thing was, you know, I when I was my last year in St. Union's, Billy, I should have been suspended.
Really?
Because we were caught going out. We used to nip out to dances. And, of course, that wasn't allowed. I remember one night being caught coming in the window at 2 or 3 in the morning. Caught by no other person than the one that I had the greatest regard for in the college, Dr. Cunha.
he caught you.
And I remember we had to, it was the then Bishop, Dr. McNeely. And I remember Father Arthur McLoon sort of pleading for us, oh no, this just, you know, just leave
school
them.
Schoolboys crying.
Yeah.
And you could have been expelled, couldn't you?
Well, we could have been expelled, and possibly might have, should have been expelled.
So
but that actually, that incident turned into what to me was the greatest, I turned it into the greatest, into a very advantageous setup. In that then, during our leaving certificate, we weren't allowed down the town at all. Mm. So I used to spend all my time studying. So in actual fact, it really was in my favour.
Everything that has happened to you in your life, comes, right? You've been able to turn to advantage.
Well, you know, that certainly turned out. Mm. But when I went down to university, I didn't know what I was doing. I was on way down. It's so different now, as you know.
Mm.
And I went down and I thought, what will I do? And I went through the courses. I think had there been a course in veterinary in Galway, and I had to go to Galway because of my Gaeltacht scholarship.
Mm.
I think I probably would have done veterinary because I would have some association coming from the country. I thought a vet was really the...
Sure.
And I asked the lady at where we were signing on, and I said, could you get me the length of courses? And medicine took 6 years. That was the longest course. Yeah. So I decided to take advantage of the scholarship and get value for money. And that's how I went into medicine.
Simple as that.
And I remember some years ago, meeting a friend of mine who was a year ahead of me and who did medicine for the called John Duffy from Aranmore Island, and he's now a cardiologist in Galway. He went down, similar circumstances, didn't really know what he was doing, decided to do engineering, and in his first morning into at class, he went into a biology class by mistake. Left the biology, came out and switched to medicine.
Heavens above.
Yeah, I mean, that thing can't happen now. It just couldn't happen. But that was how I got into medicine, purely and utterly by accident. And I don't regret it. I have no regrets. I wouldn't have said possibly maybe until my fifth or sixth year there did I really start sort of feeling, well, yes, I want to be a doctor.
And it was sort of, life was fun and a prank.
It was all fun. Yeah.
But you were entitled really, to it for
it
fun,
was.
Were you
I think so at that stage. It was all fun, really. And then during my fifth, sixth years, as I used to go around the wards, and we were being allowed on to the wards at that stage.
In which hospital you'd
done? In the hospital in Galway, in the university.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And the one thing that stands out in my mind in those days is that we were never allowed to talk to people who were dying or who were terminally ill.
As students, you were not allowed
no,
to talk?
No, we weren't, full stop. We were not. Death was never mentioned, ever, ever mentioned. And I remember seeing mothers, fathers there, and they would have seen in me and in other students there along with me with friends, possibly as their sons.
Yeah.
And I felt they wanted to reach out to me and talk to me. But whenever we did that, we were told, no, you're here to learn how to cure people. And I never saw anybody die when I was a student.
You weren't allowed to?
I wasn't allowed to. And I think that was a big, big failing in our education. And that had to come later on. After I qualified, I went to spend 2 years in Ballinasloe. I mean, an area I loved dearly. And really, the Galway people are so like Donegal people.
Mm. Yes, my brother-in-law is in Ballinasloe.
I know Mike, and I know Christine very well.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I spent a week down there with him. I've known Mike for a long time because I worked alongside him in Altna Galvin, both as an anaesthetist and then when he worked as an obstetrician. So I know Mike extremely well.
We're talking about my sister and her husband, folks.
Yeah, and Christine I know very well, too, because I was her GP in Derry.
Yeah. She knew I was talking to you, and she sends her love, by the way.
Thank you very much. Ballinasloe Hospital. Yeah, the Portiuncla Hospital. And there I sort of started thinking, right, what I wanted to do with my life. And it was then that I thought, and the surgeon, Mr. McCormick, I worked alongside with, he wanted me to do, to specialise in surgery. I was very keen to do surgery. But I realised that in those days you couldn't do surgery unless you had a lot of money behind you.
Why? The money was so low. Was it?
Oh, it's dreadful. And you'd have to, nothing like what it is now. You'd have to spend quite a number of years, really. And it was only people who did surgery or specialised in surgery were people who had money.
Independent means, yeah.
Yeah, and I felt right, I had to give something back to my parents.
Mm.
And I thought, right, the quickest way to do that was to get into general practice somewhere along the line.
All right. Let me take you now to... at what stage did you meet your wife?
Well, I came in 1960, I came to Derry.
So this is all later?
Later,
this
yeah.
is all later.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
I'll ask you then, when we come to the appropriate part, you can bring her in. But what would your fourth choice record be, Tom?
Well, I think now that we're going to talk about my wife, Deirdre, and our family, etc.
Right, okay.
Then it has to, obviously, to be something to do with Spanish holidays.
You go to Spain in your holidays?
When the kids were growing up, we went every year, even though we couldn't afford other things. And, you know, in those days, in the late 60s, early 70s, it was tough as a GP because there wasn't that much money around in those days. But the one thing we always made sure is that we always took 2 or 3 weeks holidays. And those obviously are very, very precious. So obviously it's got to be something that reminds me of Spanish holidays.
Well, how about a little bit of castanet clicking and a tune called Valencia?
Why not?
Look, we're talking about the wife now, Deirdre.
Deirdre, I met in Borderland.
In Borderland?
In Borderland. Everybody in those days went to Borderland on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
So I met Deirdre in Borderland.
And the fruits of the union are many?
We have four family.
Four?
Two boys, two girls. The eldest boy, Kieran. Next is Aisling, the eldest girl. And then we have Ronan and Sinead.
Very nice.
The names, by the way, came from Sinead Van de Valera's Book of Irish Poems.
Oh, yes.
That's where those names, because we have no actually family names as such in it.
I mean, all,
there were no Kierans or Aislinns or Ronans or Sinead in our family.
Right. So that's why you chose them after the book.
Yes, yeah.
They're all doing well, the kids?
They are. The eldest, Kieran, is a chiropodist. He's still at home with us. Aislinn's nursing. Ronan works for Abbey National, and Sinead is still at home.
Mm-hmm. So. Are you a good father to them, Tom, do you think?
I think I could be a better father to them, in the sense that certainly in recent years I think I've been away from them far too much.
Shades of your own upbringing, perhaps. Not quite as bad.
No, not really, but I think my involvement, especially with the hospice, etc., that really I've been away from them too long, you know. And
What about the earliest years, the formative years? Did you devote more time to them than your father did to you?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Well, the formative years are the most important, aren't they, really?
Yeah. Oh, yes. In those years, I wasn't as much involved in hospice, and I was able to, obviously, you know, help them with their homework and various things like that, and hopefully influence them along with Deirdre.
And you're living in Derry?
We're living in Shandon Park.
Right.
In Derry.
But we'll go back again to Galway just briefly if we can. You qualified as your GP, and then you became a general practitioner. That was 1962. That's 30 years ago.
I spent 2 years in Altnagelvin when I came in 1960-62, and then went into practice with Dr. Peter Fallon 30 years ago, and I've been in that practice ever since.
In Derry.
And recently, Dr. Fallon, myself, and Dr. Vincent Kavanagh, between us, have now 100 years practice between
and a large number of patients look at.
We have about 13,000 patients, but we now have 7 doctors.
It
makes it that much easier.
Now, how did you get involved in the hospice movement? What gave you the idea of, because you talked and you know you were concerned about it, you never saw a patient die?
No, and then once I started going into practice, obviously, first of all, I learned a lot from Dr. Fallon, especially about patients that were dying with cancer. In 1968, it's now well documented, I was looking after an 18-year-old boy who was dying of cancer.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't really do very well with him because I wasn't prepared.
It's Michael Donaghy.
Michael Donaghy.
Yeah.
And this was a young lad of 18 who was dying. And basically I used to go to see him when he was crying out in pain, because that's what we were told at that time, right? And we would maybe give him an injection of morphine, and then you wouldn't really see him, that person again, until they cried out in pain again.
Mm.
And one day before I gave him his injection, he said to me that he would like to talk to me about death and about dying, what was ahead of him. And I failed him because I didn't know. Nobody had ever asked me that before. And here was a young lad of 18 trying to reach out for some explanation why he, at 18, should be dying and what was ahead of him. And, of course, I couldn't answer him. And that was how I got involved in hospice. I vowed that would never again happen to me. And that if it was going to happen to me, then I should think seriously of getting out of general practice altogether. And that started my involvement with the hospice. I spent a lot of time in England. I visited especially St. Joseph's Hospice in Hackney. I then put hospice type of philosophy and treatment into practice in our own practice initially. And then it became obvious that that had to be extended to other parts of the city. I started talking, giving talks, lectures, and all over Northern Ireland in about the mid-70s, long before there was any talk anywhere about hospice in Northern Ireland, talking to medical students, talking to doctors, talking to nurses. And then this went on, and I always intended to start and collect money for a hospice, but it was tough in those days. There wasn't too much money around in the mid-70s, and certainly from the point of view of getting any help from the health service at that time, that was completely out. And then in the early 80s, when it was getting very obvious that something more than a local service that we were providing for our own patients, that had to take place, and I got involved. And in 1983, during a female run, it came to my attention that the Northern Ireland Hospice had started to collect money in Derry, and I felt that has to be stopped. This was no reflection on the hospice in Belfast, but I felt that any money must stay in the city.
Mm.
And suddenly one night I just stood up at this female run when we were having, it was a practice run, and said...
What do you mean a female run?
There was a Foyle female five, there was where all females had been invited to run, and I said, we must start collecting money for a hospice, and that was in September 83, and that was the start of the fundraising thing, which now has taken 9 years, and from then on it just went from strength to strength. I set myself a target that for the first year we would collect £100,000. First, at the end of the first year, we actually had collected £120,000. 9 years later on, we have collected, given by a very, very caring community and all across that divide, we have been given £1.5 million for the building and the land. We have provided a home care service for the last 6-7 years. And now it takes about £500,000 a year to run our inpatient unit. And all of that money has been given by that community. And that community includes Donegal, Tyrone and Derry. Because from day one, Billy, we didn't recognise the border. There should never be any boundaries as regards terminal care or cancer. There can't be any religious boundaries, geographical boundaries or any boundary. So we actually provided a service from day one.
Is it true that you got the site from the Orange Order?
Yes. And that site was very important to us because my mother, getting back to my mother again, she was the lady in the village in Derrybeg in that area who, when somebody died, she was the one who prepared the body.
She was called.
Yeah. And she always talked about death as part of a journey. She was the one who really introduced me to that philosophy that we're all on a journey and that death is only part of it and that that leads to a better life. So with that in mind, the hospice always had to face the bridge and had to face the river.
Yeah.
And of course, the site owned by the Orange Order was the only site that was suitable in Derry because that looked at the bridge. It was completely symbolic. And what we said from day one as well, that the hospice movement could never ever be successful unless we also bridge the gap between the two communities. Mm. And that we have done. Nobody can dispute that one. Mm. So it was vital to us that it was symbolic. So every room now in that hospice looks at the bridge, looks at the river. And what we have said is, right, that what we're trying to do in conjunction with many other medical personnel, nurses, doctors, lay people, is that what we're trying to do is to bridge a gap between life and death.
Very good.
And that was why this site was vital to us. And I mean, I for years tried to get that site and I was really over the moon when they decided, right, you can have that site.
Did you buy it or did they donate?
We bought it.
You bought it.
But
They
made it available to us at a very reasonable price. Mm. They also gave us the first £1,000 symbolic brick.
Did they?
And as well as that, they have also donated a lovely painting for us, which actually shows the site as it was. But the site was vital. Billy.
Fantastic.
Oh, yes, yeah. It was vital.
So the people of Derry have been have been very good, haven't they?
Oh, yes.
Can we go on to your fifth record?
Well, obviously it has to be something to do with Derry.
I would have thought so.
Because Derry is my adopted city. It has given me and my employment for the last 30 years. Mm. My family have grown up there. Mm. My wife, Deirdre, is not from Derry. Originally, she's from Enniskillen.
I forgot to ask you that.
She's from Enniskillen. Mm. So, and as well as that, this next song is, I have lived through those times.
Mm.
I have seen a lot of the things happen. But I think now there's a lot of optimism in Derry and we've got beyond that.
Mm.
And where the communities are working together. And now we have a beautiful city.
Mm.
But obviously the town I love so well has to be my next record.
Joseph Locke.
I will always see the town that I have loved so well, where our school played ball by the gas-heater wall, and we laughed through the smoke and the smell. Going home in the rain, running up the dark lane, past the jail and down behind the fountain. Those were happy days in so many, many ways, in the town I loved so well.
Joe Locke has come back into favour recently.
Yes.
It's quite an interesting version of the town I love so well. Tom, have you time for a hobby?
Oh, yes.
What do you do?
Yeah, I run. That's my hobby. Very few evenings that I will not go out and run 5-6 miles, and a weekend maybe 10-12.
You feel a lot better for it?
Oh, yes. I mean, that is my release valve. Mm. I think everybody needs some sort of relaxation.
And that's it.
And I've done a lot of marathons over the years.
You've raised money for the hospice.
Yes, I suppose the largest amount was 2 years ago in the London Marathon. My eldest son, Kieran, a friend of mine, Pat McGart from the Derry Journal, and Bernadette Mount, we raised between us £25,000 for the hospice.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
I've done the New York Marathon because obviously I wanted to go back to where I was born.
Mm.
I had never been back.
Had you not?
No, my mother always wanted me to go back. And luckily enough, I managed to get back a year or two before she died.
You have had a lot of awards recently, if I could just briefly enumerate them. Correct me if I'm wrong. People of the Year Award last November.
That was November, yes.
Donegal Person of the Year in March this year.
That was the big one.
That was a biggie. City Council have presented you with a beautiful painting in Derry, from the Derry City Council.
Yeah.
A lovely painting.
Yeah, I was delighted that Mary Bradley, she's been so helpful to us and so supportive of the hospice. Lovely, beautiful. I think she has done our city proud.
Good. And I think you're about to get another one from the GAA in Gwydor, is that right?
Yeah, on the Friday the 24th, they're there, in conjunction with the local hospice group there, are making a presentation. Of course, that one will be very special to me as well.
Once again, you see, the problem is we've hardly time to play the music, and I know that your last piece is from Gwydor. We'd better play a little bit of a tone before we finish.
Oh, yes. I mean, I have a passionate love for Gwydor.
Mm.
I've never made any
bones about that.
And really, if I was away, then it has to be Glant and Gloss Gwydor.
It's not exceptionally in the they do wrong. On the stock is hard, they pathetical heart, mysterious, complete, discord. The wish, wish a heart may evoke a look you in the wonder.
That was the Johnsons and a wee bit of Glanta Glasgow Door. Have you any regrets, Tom, in your life, if you were to do it all again?
No, I think everybody has regrets. I don't think I have any major regrets. The one regret obviously has to be that I didn't get to know my father well. And as I get older, that annoys me more and more.
Mm.
And I don't know what I could have done about it. Circumstances dictated that we were to be apart. And by the time I felt I wanted to do something about it, it wasn't possible to build up this rapport. Mm. It just was impossible.
It was too late.
Yeah. That would have to be my major regret. Other than that, I've been very, very lucky.
Right. Let's get on to the island then, Tom. We're giving you the Bible. And what two books would you choose to take with you?
Well, what I would love to do is take all of Chaucer and Seamus McGreehan's books with me. But since I'm just restricted to one, then it would have to be on Drum o' Moore.
The Big Drum.
The Big Drum by Chaucer McGreehan.
Right.
And just yesterday, I heard on radio, this drum has been locked up since 1936. I used to play the drummy bugger, the wee drums, in the band in Derrybeg, which was just next door to where I lived.
Mm.
And all of this is so relevant to me.
Right.
So that would be one of my books.
And your second one?
And the second would have to be something to do with Irish mythology. And recently, Father Pat Crilly gave me this one, Ancient Irish Tales by Cross and Slover.
Nice book. All right. And one luxury.
I think, provided I got a few more lessons in the violin, then I would take the violin with me. And since I would have plenty of time, then it would become a challenge to learn how to play the violin.
Well, apart from learning to play the violin, would you be good on the island with your hands? Could you make a shelter?
Yes, I could. Yes, yeah. I'd be very good with a pick and shovel or any of those things. Thanks. Not necessarily with the finer things of building or anything but no, I'd be quite happy.
And with your own company, Tom?
I think my own company, yes, for a while, but after a while, I'm sure, you know.
Well, you have the music and the books and the violin.
Music and the books,
It's all good company.
It's good company.
Dr. Tom McGinley, thank you very much indeed for being my castaway, and thank you very much indeed for the work that you have done for the people of the Northwest, and continued success, Tom.
Thank you very much, Billy. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.